sunshine and 61 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking today about a powerful film made back in 2003, but that remains as timely as ever, especially in light of the terrible events out of Charlottesville, Virginia this past weekend. The film is called Two Towns of Jasper, and it actually springs from a horrific hate crime which occurred back in 1998 when three white men essentially kidnapped a 49-year-old black man by the name of James Byrd Jr., chained him to the back of a truck, and dragged him to his death in horrific fashion. This film follows the citizens of Jasper as the trials are held for each of these three men. And the film was made by two filmmakers who were also friends of one another, Whitney Dow and Marco Williams, one white, one black. And they went to Jasper with two separate film crews, one white, one black, in order to capture the candid views of the citizens of Jasper, both white and black. Jasper, Texas, on the surface, was in many respects a more positive community than one might imagine existing in the Deep South. But beneath the surface, past the sort of promising signs of racial harmony in this town, lurks a more disturbing and complicated picture. Again, this film was made in 2003, and it is being rebroadcast this week on PBS's POV. It was my pleasure to speak with Whitney Dow and Marco Williams, and I began our interview by asking Marco Williams to explain what happened back in 1998 to James Byrd Jr.
Some would describe what happened on June 8th, 1998, as the most heinous racially motivated murder in a generation. It was equated with what happened to Emmett Till in Money, Mississippi. Specifically, on the night of June 8th, 1998, James Byrd Jr., an African-American man, was walking home, and he was met by three men in a pickup truck who allegedly invited him to join them drinking a beer. And what occurred afterwards is that they did drink beer together. They took Mr. Byrd to a deserted road, a logging road in Jasper, Texas. They beat him up. They pulled his pants down. They stripped him of his shirt. They spray-painted his genitalia black. They chained him to the back of a pickup truck, and they drove down a road called Huff Creek Road, approximately 3 miles, evidently dragging Mr. Byrd, swerving back and forth along the road. And the culmination was that at a certain point, the car and Mr. Byrd swung to the side of the road, hitting a concrete culvert that decapitated his left shoulder and head. That was the incident that was then called in to the local sheriff's office, which is in many ways where our film begins, when the sheriff visits the road, followed up by a call for mortuary services to come and retrieve the body. And at that moment, our film starts with a perception of the events from the perspective of a white sheriff and black mortuary directors.
Hmm. And of course, eventually we hear from all sorts of citizens of Jasper, Texas, black and white alike, as they view the events that unfold, and in particular, the three separate trials of the three white men charged with this horrific crime. Can you explain, Marco Williams, the circumstances under which these arrests took place? The impression we're given in the film is that these arrests happened almost immediately. How was it that so quickly these three men were identified and brought into custody?
Yes. What I'd like to just share is that initially it was thought by the sheriff to be a hit-and-run accident because there was a blood trail on the road. And the first thinking was, well, this is going to be very easy to, deer or a person got hit. It's going to lead to a very clear resolution. It wasn't so clear immediately because it was very clear that there was something much more horrific that occurred. But the three men accused and then ultimately convicted were not, they had been drinking. I'm not suggesting that that made them less culpable. But they had been drinking, and I'm going to chuckle. Surprisingly, tools were found at the starting point of this tragedy, and the tools had the names of one of the three perpetrators on it. So they were immediately able to kind of find that person, and from that they then learned that these three men had been out drinking and gradually stitched together, at the very least, enough evidence to arrest all three men.
Whitney Dow, let's shift to you and have you explain the circumstances under which the two of you, friends, but living, I think, in different places at the time, in a sense, came together to want to capture events in Jasper, Texas, as they unfolded. Explain the circumstances under which the two of you, one way or another, had the idea of trying to make some kind of film about this story, and what was the primary catalyst in wanting to do that?
Well, I was at home one night, and I saw a news conference come on, and it was being headed by Billy Wolves, the sheriff of Jasper, Texas, describing this crime. It was sort of my first my first introduction to the crime. And he was so striking, and the story was so striking. And what he was talking about was this horrible crime, and that, in fact, there was going to be a Klan rally in support of the white community after the crime. I thought that was sort of a strange construct, that after this horrible racial murder had happened, that there was going to be a rally in favor of the white community, in support of the white community. And I also, you know, he also talked about the Black Panthers were coming. The whole situation struck me so much, this sort of horrible crime that really had all the hallmarks of things that we kind of hoped were in our past. It really felt like a modern-day lynching. And I decided at that point to go right away to Jasper. And as a filmmaker, one of the things that we're lucky about is that we have sort of this tool to explore things that confuse us we want to know about. And so I decided to go down there that weekend with a camera person, a friend of mine, Stephen Miller, and film the events, not really having a particular idea of what I was going to do. And I went down there, and aside from filming the Klan rally, aside from going to Black Panthers, which just felt like a lot of exterior froth, one of the things that really, really struck me when I was down there that first weekend was how differently the white community and the black community were processing the event. Is that the white community told one narrative. They told one story. They sort of said, well, you know, this community is so just that God chose it for this horrible crime to take place, because we're the one community that could withstand such a horrible event. And they kind of almost saw it as affirming their righteousness, that immediately the people were identified, immediately they were arrested and charged with this murder. And the black community told a fundamentally different narrative, and that was the narrative that this is business as usual. White people have been killing black Americans, black Texans for years. And this is just one more example of white people feeling that they could indiscriminately take black lives. And so when I came back, I've known Marco since we were teenagers. And Marco, as you said, he was living in North Carolina at the time. I was living in New York City. And we talked about the film. And one thing that struck me then was also how different our take on the events were, is that there was a similar split in our processing of the crime.
You mean between the two of you, between you and Marco, you mean?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That I was outraged by the crime, couldn't believe that it happened, was very upset about it. And Marco was a little more blasé at the beginning. He said, well, this, you know, again, this is not an extraordinary, it's an extraordinary crime, but it's not necessarily an extraordinary event.
Right. In some ways, it was terrible, but in a sense, all too ordinary an occurrence. Whereas for you,
right.
You had no full appreciation of just how ordinary something as terrible as this could be in certain parts of the country.
Exactly. I think that I think there's a sense of, you know, for white Americans that our sense of ourselves are caught up in this idea of American exceptionalism, and that this idea that these horrible things from our history or horrible things that happen that reflect on our society are aberrations as opposed to pieces of a structure that existed since we were, you know, since the country was founded. And I think things that reveal that to us are very, very, very unsettling.
Mm.
So anyway, fast forwarding a little bit to Marco and I continued conversations. I'd wanted to make a film about this from the get-go, and we've talked about the possibility of working together and the idea of making something from two different perspectives seemed like a very logical way to pursue the endeavor, that essentially there were such different narratives taking place in the community, it made sense that we would capture them separately. So what we decided to do was film. I would go down with a white crew and live in the white community and film the white residents and talk to the white residents during the course of the three trials with the three local men. And Marco would go down with a black film crew and live in the black community and film the black residents of Jasper. And then we made the decision not to look at each other's footage, not to sort of reveal what we were working on and see if we could spend a year sort of filming these two separate narratives and then find a way to stitch them together at the end of the process.
My understanding from reading, I think, an interview, the transcript of an interview with the two of you, is that this was, to some extent, a controversial choice, at least as far as some people were concerned. And I think I remember specific mention being made of potential funders, that some of the people who were approached to underwrite the making of this film evidently had some misgivings about whether or not it was appropriate to attack the project in this respect with two, in a sense, racially segregated film crews. Can you tell us more about the way in which at least some people found this disconcerting, and if even you yourselves, to some extent, felt at least a little bit of discomfort at the notion that this was the best way to proceed?
Well, it's sort of funny, you know, the pushback you get from funders on your ideas sometimes are a good indication of how strong an idea it is. You know, it was funny for us because we thought this was such a logical, simple idea, and I think we were first kind of taken aback at the pushback that we got from the funders and people saying, well, you're creating a dynamic that's going to bring racial divisions to the fore. You're creating this sort of this artificial dynamic, and it seems so logical to us. And I think that anybody, you know, who thinks about it for more than a minute, that white people's experience living, white Americans' experience living in this country is so fundamentally different than black Americans' experience living in this country. It's as if we inhabit different realities. And it would just, and it seems to follow that it's a very different model when you talk to somebody about something rather than explaining something to them. And we had also, one of the things that Mark and I talked a lot about was this idea that there was no functional language to discuss race across race, and we thought that perhaps we could allow people to listen in on conversations as opposed to create this artificial construct to explain to people. But to get back to your original question about people being sort of getting pushback on it, we got all kinds of pushback. And I think that in general, and Marco can sort of, expound on this a little bit, but I think that most of the big institutions and most of the big money institutions are built off a white liberal. I think there's a white liberal structure. And as someone who's a dedicated white liberal, the biggest pushback I've gotten investigating race and doing a number of projects on race have always come from white liberals who really don't want to recognize how they are not necessarily, I guess, they're really implicated in how the structure of white supremacy and structural racism is perpetuated and how they exist and benefit from that structure.
Interesting. And again, you're saying that as you yourself counting yourself as a white liberal.
Absolutely. Yes, the most liberal.
Interesting.
I think that this is more clear. I think another factor at this moment is that our decision to make this film came in the sort of social aftermath of the O.J. Simpson trial, which was perhaps a most explicit moment for many Americans of the cleave or the chasm between how black and white Americans saw particular events. And I think that there was probably a tremendous discomfort on the part of, again, the white liberal, as Whitney has referenced, to the idea of having to acknowledge and recognize that fact. That yes, black and white Americans, as Whitney has described, are realities, even when they're shared experience or university experience, living in the same town, et cetera. It's still very fundamentally different. And I think that to your question of how did it impact us, it meant that we had to engage in conversation and figure out how we came to an understanding about our own perceptions, how we saw particular events. I'll offer an example that occurred early in the editing when we put together our sample reel for our funder. And the output began with somebody who was white speaking and concluded with somebody who was white speaking. And I expressed that, well, wait a second, if we're going to have this kind of exploration of how we see things, how we or how the community see things, or how black and white Americans see things differently, you can't have a white person start and conclude the conversation. There needs to be at least an effective balance, or at least a recognition that there are two sides of the equation. And so that manifested itself at different times in our work together. And I think that the outcome, it is far superior, i.e. the outcome of a film where the filmmakers themselves have to interrogate and figure out how to understand one another across a racial boundary. I think that informs and imbues the final film itself.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Whitney Dow and Marco Williams, who are the producers and directors of a very important documentary film that premiered on PBS's POV back in 2003, called Two Towns of Jasper. And it was made in the wake of a horrific hate crime in June of 1998, in which a middle-aged black man by the name of James Byrd Jr. Was, in a sense, captured by three younger white men, chained to a truck, and dragged to his death in the most savage, brutal way imaginable. And the two of them went to Jasper, Texas, during the period in which these three white men each went on trial, facing charges of murder. And with two separate film crews, one white, one black, to try to capture the most candid kind of conversations from the citizens of Jasper following these events and reacting to them. Whitney Dow, I want to ask you about what it was like for you to be recording the comments of people like the people of something called the Bubba's in Training Breakfast Club. We see them at several points during the film, and this would be kind of the proverbial group of folks who meet on a regular basis for breakfast at Burger King or wherever it might be and kind of pontificate on the world. We've seen that. Maybe some of us are even part of groups sort of like that. I wonder if you can just say a word about what it was like to spend time with some of these folks from Jasper who thought of themselves as Bubbas in Training, and what it was like to capture the comments that they had, that to varying degrees, of course, revealed some prejudice and racism that perhaps they themselves weren't even fully conscious of having.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, if you look at the film, when people watch it, everybody in the film is representational in some way, meaning that they each sort of represent a particular faction of the community. They're not just individuals, but we're also sort of very consciously thinking about who they represented, who they were speaking for in a broader understanding of the community. And when I got to know the Bubbas, and they met at this place called the Belgium Hotel, and they were a cross-section of sort of middle-class white Jasperites, we sort of really thought of them as representation of mainstream white Jasper, you know, conventional thinking. And so I was very careful when I was shooting. I think I shot them 30 times, 30 breakfasts, where they would sit for an hour and talk and have breakfast and joke with each other. And that we went to edit together, I was really looking for pieces that really kind of reflected the community, and I put words in the mouth of them that I heard everywhere. And so I think that what you're probably trying to get at is that because they said very, very racist things at times, that what was my reaction to it? And I think that sometimes there's a confusion as to what sort of the role of a documentary filmmaker is. There's sort of two sides, but one is that you're so consumed with sort of logistics of like capturing a particular scene that a lot of times things that are happening don't necessarily register with you. But the other thing is that I really see this incredible, the relationship that you have with your subject, especially when you make a film over a year the way we make it, you have to have this incredible level of trust. And I was so grateful that the people as Bubbas trusted me enough that they would speak freely in front of me and talk to me honestly about what they believed and felt. And I always, you know, and one of the things, sort of the guiding principle is that I was, you know, when I'm making a film, is to really represent people accurately. And so I don't really view it as my role to debate people or challenge them when they're saying things. I think that's sort of an assumption some of the audience think, that they think, oh, when they say this horrible racist thing, how does the filmmaker respond? Well, I kind of view my role as being their advocate, meaning to present their position accurately and strongly, not necessarily in figuring out whether it's right or wrong. So I think that I really felt more grateful that they trusted me enough to speak honestly and openly rather than feeling shocked by what they were saying.
Right. And I think it's probably important for us to say, and I have to phrase this very carefully, but one of the things that is most interesting here is the fact that while the group presents itself in ways that a lot of us would find pretty distasteful, on the spectrum of racists, there are ways in which they are by no means at the far end of the spectrum. That is, they are careful to express sorrow, to some extent at least, over what has occurred to James Byrd, even if in the next phrase they are sort of calling into question whether or not he should be venerated and memorialized. And so, I mean, there are all kinds of qualifications they immediately sort of attach to their sorrow. But one can imagine going to some places in the South where certain white people could not bring themselves to even do that. I mean, to feel the least bit of sincere sorrow over what had occurred. Am I characterizing that fairly in saying that while they are certainly racist, they also present kind of a complicated picture of maybe what racism looks like and sounds like in many places in America today?
Yes, and not just the South. I would say also the North as well.
Of course.
Go ahead, Marco.
This is Marco. While I had no direct encounters with the Bubbas in training, while we made the film and met them only after we finished making the film and when we went to show it in Jasper as part of a town hall meeting that Ted Koppel held called America in Black and White, I actually would like to say this, and I often say this after our screenings. To a certain extent, I think that one has to see the Bubbas in training as the white moderate or the white liberals of the town. But more importantly, that language is perhaps one of the most dangerous aspects of oppression, whatever form of ism that you would like to consider. And I always say that very few of us are going to be a participant, much less a witness to a racially motivated murder. But almost all of us at one time or another find ourselves in a situation where someone says something about somebody else based on their gender, their sexual orientation, their religion, their race, their ethnicity, et cetera, et cetera. And how do we respond? And so I think what Whitney was able to present in that particular scenario is an insight into most of America, regardless of in this case, racial identity or skin color, that you could be at a black dinner table and certain things might be said. You could be at a Jewish dinner table, you know, I could go on. And so I think that's where one really has to look at those scenes, not for the fact that one of them at one point in the film talks about the use of the word, using the N-word, so to speak. That's easy almost. It's everything else that's being said that is a reminder to all of us of how we reflect and engage and how we think about the other. Or the person who's not ourselves.
Right. Well put. Whitney Dow, one thing that as we follow these Bubbas through the course of the film and what they say, one has at least a little bit of a sense that what they are expressing becomes, in a sense, maybe a bit more muted or nuanced as the film goes on. Or at least that's the impression we get. And I wonder if that's, in fact, what occurred as time went on. Did you sense at least a little bit of transformation of their attitudes and maybe a softening of some of their prejudices or not? I mean, at the end of this period that you were talking with them, were their attitudes largely unchanged?
I think in some ways they were unchanged. I mean, I think what you're probably sensing is that the way that the trials were constructed is that there were three men involved in the murder. There was John William King, who was sort of the ringleader, who was sort of evil incarnate. And you could sort of really sort of look at him and say, oh, he was this virulent white supremacist who had just come out of prison. There was prison buddy, Brewer, John Brewer. And then there was Sean King, who was sort of a local boy who worked at the movie theater, who's childhood friends of John King. And what sort of happened is that John was tried, then King was tried, then Brewer, then Barry. And what happened is that they immediately sort of focused on how evil the Brewer and King were. And when we got to Barry, it was almost as if the town itself was on trial, because he was a local friend of everybody. He managed the movie theater. Everybody knew him. And so he was really, really hard to explain away how he would participate in it. So I think that they were kind of looking forward to this trial because they thought, oh, well, this is kind of going to be, I kind of got the sense that this was kind of going to sort of put the town in a better light, when in fact it kind of put the town in a worse light. And so I think that that what you were sensing in them is really their inability to explain away how somebody who was very, very mainstream, very much of the town, could participate in an event like this.
Right, and not somebody on the extreme fringe. Yes, that is where so much of that lies. And, of course, whether or not he is going to be convicted is one of the highest points of suspense in this whole story. Marco Williams, you speak with many blacks in Jasper, Texas, and many of them are part of the family of James Byrd Jr., the man who was killed. They are a very impressive group in so many respects, particularly in the way that they conduct themselves with such dignity through an experience that in no way could have been easy, not just in dealing with such a heartbreaking loss, but also being thrust into the spotlight of media attention in a way that no one would welcome. I wonder if you could say a word about what it was like to interact with them at such a difficult point in their lives, and the kind of the ways in which you went about trying not to intrude on them in a way that would make the situation even more painful.
Well, you're absolutely so. The James Byrd Jr.'s family really, in many ways, represented the way in which I would say that black community of Jasper has often dealt with crisis, and that would be in a more dignified fashion. But also, the fact of the matter is he had five or six sisters, living parents, three children, and just to speak to you as a filmmaker, first and foremost, it's not so clear in situations such as that as to who is the representative voice for the family. And so when you watch Tales of Jasper, what I think I efforted to do, was give you a sense of the inner workings of the family, the complexity of the family, the different shades of emotion. And what pleases me, and because of the fact that the film spans practically a year, is that you see them go from really uncertain of how to be in the media spotlight to evolving into their valid rage, their extreme hurt, and little by little, each person's personality emerges. And so at the beginning of the film, they are very kind of, holding themselves together and holding back. And by the end of the film, they have no problem with saying exactly how they feel. And so in concert with what Whitney described about the Bubbas and their feelings about the third trial and Sean Berry, it is Sean Berry that becomes really the focus of their real, the Byrd family's real frustration and anger because of his defense, which was that he was there, but that he was too afraid to do something. And their rage and frustration with Barry because they also knew Barry. They know him because he was part of the town. And so the film offers a kind of evolving arc of sort of quiet dignity to enraged dignity.
Mm. Whitney Dow, I want to take a moment to have you talk about your interactions with the brother of Sean Berry. And I have to say that some of the most extraordinary moments in this film come as we encounter this young man who is wrestling with his own complicated feelings about his brother and what his brother did, his complicity in this terrible crime, and yet his sense that his brother was not as guilty as the other two men involved in this. And I'm very impressed at how you were able to capture him in such candid conversation, sometimes with very, very colorful, unbridled language, and at other times trying to present his thoughts in maybe more polished, nuanced fashion. But whatever one thinks of what his brother did, I found myself really feeling for this young man and his, in a sense, inadvertent role in all of this. What were your impressions of Lewis Berry, the brother of Sean Berry, and what he had to say in this film?
I mean, Lewis was a really, really, really tragic character. I mean, imagine, from everything that I know about Lewis, he was just, in my time as I saw him, just a good kid. He came from a very complicated family background, a broken family. He was sort of trying to make his way in the world. And he was forced during that year to go through this arc where he had to come to terms with the fact that his brother, who he loved, committed this horrific crime. And as you allude to this, you can really see it in the scenes as they progress, is that he starts very much in this place of in total denial about what happened, and trying to find any sort of rational way as to how his brother could be innocent of these charges, or how he could have been under duress, or any sort of excuse. And by the end of the film, he sort of comes to this brutal realization that his brother was a complicit and actor in it. And it was. Like I said about Bubba's, I really felt it sounds sort of corny, but in a way you feel really privileged in a sense to be in people in these moments where these going to these major transition points in life, and I like you, I felt a lot of sympathy for him. And, a human sympathy for him. And I think, but he also, the other thing is that he did kind of, we're talking about being representational, is that he also represented the town itself trying to come to terms with the fact that Sean committed this crime.
I wonder
go ahead.
I was going to say, I wonder if you would mind describing a really interesting scene which occurs towards the end of the film between this young man, Lewis Berry, the brother of Sean Berry, and a local radio announcer who is kind of a persistent presence in the film, a statement of sorts, which Lewis Berry ends up recording. Just say a word.
What was interesting about that, that scene was that it was really precipitated, I felt, by the events in the trial and being confronted on the lawn by one of Marco's characters, Ethel Williams, who... He, up until that point, he'd maintained his brother's innocence. And he comes out of the courthouse, and he's confronted by Ethel and says, "Why did you leave?" And he says, "Well, I didn't want him to see me, and I didn't want him to not feel comfortable talking about it during the point when Sean is testifying." And really what's so clear is that he knew at that moment when his brother got on the stand that he was guilty. And he sort of went directly from that. Up until that point, there have been a lot of questions in town as why haven't the Berries spoken up and sort of expressed their condolences to the Byrds? How can they have approached the Byrds? And he goes to the radio DJ, radio station, this guy Mike Lout, who's a local news reporter, and writes and reads a statement on there apologizing to the Byrds family. And I think it's what's really sort of touching about that scene and also instructive about the scene is that not only does he not really have the words to say it, and that he even says, I didn't know what to say or how to say it, but it's also that he even at that point when he recognizes his brother is guilty, he can't even approach the birds directly. There's such a division in the town and a division between races that he actually goes and apologizes to the white radio station owner. He doesn't make a personal statement. He goes to the white radio station owner and writes it and broadcasts it. And really, and in fact, KJAS is not really listened to by the black community. When you see that scene cuts direct, he's making this apology, and it cuts to the bird's house, and they're watching, you know, some news show that has nothing to do with KJAS. They're not listening to that, so it's not even clear that they even heard his statement.
Hmm. And it's so interesting how he wrestles with the wording, and at one point, the announcer is encouraging him to, well, don't say that if you don't mean that. And then Louis Bear says, but if I say just this, I'm sorry for what happened, that's not enough. I mean, it's very, very interesting to see him wrestling with what does he feel at this moment, what kind of sorrow, what kind of sympathy. He is wanting to be sincere, and he's wanting to say enough. He's not wanting to say too much or anything he doesn't really feel. It's a wrenching scene in so many respects. One thing that we've not touched on, Marco Williams, is an interesting symbol of the division in Jasper, Texas, namely a certain fence that ran down the middle of Jasper's main cemetery. Say a word about that and its symbolic importance in this story and film.
Yes, in Jasper, Texas, which is probably not different than many a small town in the South. And Jasper, though in Texas, is in Southwest Texas and probably is more aligned with the southern states than it is with the rest of Texas. That might be thought of as part of the Southwest. The cemetery had been segregated, really segregated, up until the time that we were filming. And when I say segregated, most explicitly, there was a fence that split the cemetery in half. And then the front side of the cemetery, i.e. that you entered in from the main road, you would be entering into the white side of the cemetery. And if you were to proceed beyond that or enter from the back side, sort of like the front of the bus, the back of the bus, you would be on the side of the cemetery where black citizens were buried. So at a certain point, in the town's efforts to find a way to kind of reconcile what happened and really kind of demonstrate that they could find some sort of understanding across the races, ministers get together, and it's often ministers, black and white ministers get together, and one of the things that they consider is that what we should do is take the cemetery fence down, and this will be a demonstration that Jasper is on the road to healing and reconciling racial differences. And in the film, this very event engenders a great deal of discussion from both black and white, and represented by one white character and a black character, or two white characters, two black characters. But the most startling development, I think, that we might say, is that by the end of the film, one of our characters, Ethel, her sister, passes, and certainly we're left to wondering, will Ethel's sister be buried in the Jasper Cemetery, i.e. in the white part of the cemetery? And in fact, she's buried in the black side of the cemetery. And as Ethel describes, it, in many ways, it makes perfect sense. She's buried where the rest of her family is buried. And so our film concludes with this a resolution to the crime, and with three men being found guilty of committing the crime, but in some ways that things in Jasper has not necessarily changed, that life does go on.
Hmm. I can give 1 minute to each of you to say something about what you learned through the course of making this film. Whitney Dow?
You know, one of the things that was the most challenging about the film was making it with someone who I care deeply about, Marco, my partner, and coming to the place where I think I set off on this journey thinking that Marco and I, with very similar backgrounds, went to the same high school, similar colleges, or filmmakers, that we could find agreement in almost anything. And one of the things that I learned is that was that despite our similarities, our experiences living in the world as a white American and black American are so vast and so different that there's some things between us that can never be bridged, some divides between us in understanding and that cannot be bridged. Now, that was incredibly devastating and a very, very, very difficult process to go through. But similarly, I came out of it feeling that you can not agree on things. You cannot have the same reference point. You cannot have the same sort of specific agenda, but you can achieve, you can still achieve common goals together. And Marco and I went through this process of making this film in a shared, controlled way where we had to agree on every decision, every edit, every cut, every creative decision. And so even though I came out personally kind of devastated in sort of recognizing the limitation of kind of my understanding of what it would be like to be a black American, I also came out in this incredible positive feeling of that despite those divisions, you can accomplish things and achieve common goals together.
Marco Williams, a quick lesson.
Yes, very quickly. What I learned and what I valued from the experience is that I think that when there are challenging facets of our that happen in our world, in our society, it's really worthwhile to try to take them on head on and not to, obfuscate or avoid them. And what Whitney and I accomplished with Two Towns of Jasper is that while we don't provide any simple or easy answer, we certainly present and acknowledge that if you get people talking, you're at least one step further along to figuring out how to come to some sort of understanding.
Hmm. The film, once again, is Two Towns of Jasper and now being shared in an encore presentation via PBS stations across the country and at pbs.org. And the co-directors and producers of this remarkable film, Whitney Dow and Marco Williams. Thank you so much, gentlemen, first of all, for making such a powerful and thought-provoking film and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Very best wishes to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I speak with Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. He joins us, of course, once a month to offer his perspective on a wide range of various topics. And, of course, we will be talking about the events in Charlottesville, Virginia this weekend, and we'll also be talking with him about the tensions between the United States and North Korea. Professor Sear is an expert on both South and North Korea, and I'm sure we'll have a very valuable perspective to add. On Wednesday, a much lighter topic. My guest will be Mary Radigan, who is executive chef at the restaurant Sazzy Bee's in downtown Kenosha. She is going to be one of the chefs featured in this weekend's upcoming Harborside Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival. And we'll give you a further preview of that event on Thursday's morning show. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto. two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and a